From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. One 100 years ago, the Spanish flu marched across the globe, leaving between 50 and 100 million people dead in its wake. An exhibit, the 1918 flu epidemic in Baltimore, 100 years later, at the Frieda O. Weiss Gallery on the University of Maryland Baltimore campus, chronicles what was going on in the city. Professor Wilbur Chen, a vaccine development specialist, tells us how the flu spreads and how to prevent it. And Tara Wink, UMB librarian and archivist, offers takeaways from what she learned in compiling the exhibit.
Being well-educated about healthcare is important. Being well-educated about what can prevent sicknesses and how to keep yourself healthy. That's an important message in this story.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Exactly 100 years ago, the virus called the Spanish flu marched across the globe. When it started, health and government officials couldn't have fathomed the number of dead the influenza would leave in its wake over the coming 2 years, between 50 and 100 million worldwide. The flu took more lives than did the Great World War that was raging at the same time. Outbreak, Epidemics in a Connected World is an exhibit at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. It chronicles the spread of the Spanish flu pandemic and illustrates how other viral diseases have spread, such as Ebola and AIDS. The exhibit has been adapted for use at the Frieda O. Weiss Gallery within the University of Maryland Health Sciences and Human Services Library. That display also features the 1918 flu epidemic in Baltimore 100 years later, which focuses on local stories of that pandemic. Later in the show, we'll talk to a UMD vaccine development specialist to better understand how the flu spreads and how to prevent it. Joining us now is Tara Wink, historical librarian and archivist at the Health Sciences and Human Services Library at UMD Baltimore. She researched and compiled information on the exhibit. Welcome, Tara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What will visitors see at the Weiss Gallery? How is the exhibit set up?
The exhibit's set up mostly in one room in the gallery space on our main floor. There are multiple parts of this exhibit. The outbreak exhibit from the Smithsonian is there. And then the rest of the pieces that talk about the 100 years of the Spanish flu are around the outsides of the gallery. So on the one wall, we have a timeline of the flu here in Baltimore.
What was that timeline?
So the timeline starts with the outbreak of World War I in April of 1917. So much before the flu was even thought about.
When the U.S. joined.
Right, when the U.S. joined. Yes, sorry. And then it goes until March of 1919 because the flu had a pretty long occurring time frame here in the United States and around the world.
And so by the spring of 1919, there were not many new cases.
Correct. By March, they started to stop seeing these cases.
So the timeline is a big part of the exhibit. What
yes.
else?
In the back part of the gallery, we do have two cases that talk about medicines and what might have worked to prevent or help you get over the flu. But some of these medicines were also interesting, we'll say, different treatments for things that you would never hear of today. And then on the outside of the gallery, we do have information about the university during the flu, what happened on campus, how students were affected, things like that.
The events of World War I and the Spanish flu are very interconnected. Talk about that and how that played out, especially here in Baltimore and Maryland.
Sure. So you can't talk about the Spanish flu without talking about the war. As I said, our exhibit starts with April 17th when the U.S. enters World War I. Why is it so interconnected? You have people moving around the world that wouldn't necessarily be moving around the world at the time. There's soldiers going off to fight the war in Europe. They're taking with them new germs that aren't aren't experienced in Europe. And these germs are just traveling back and forth as wounded come back or as soldiers come back to America. And it's easier to travel at this time than it was prior to this war.
It was called the Spanish flu. Did it actually start in Spain?
It did not. They believe that it did at the time because Spain was a neutral country. They were not involved in World War I at all. They weren't fighting. They were the only country to report on this flu that was occurring early on. So in the spring, their king actually caught the flu and they started reporting on it in their newspapers. The rest of the world wasn't really reporting on it because they were under censorships by the governments to keep morale up, to keep people not necessarily excited, but for lack of a better term, enthusiastic about the war and the war effort in fighting and winning this war for their country. So the United States was also under this. You didn't see a lot of reports of the flu. You saw a lot of reports on war efforts and we're winning the war and support the war effort by buying Liberty loans and all of that. You didn't see a whole lot about the flu, even at its peak. Here.
So what impact did that have on the pandemic? The fact that the public media weren't talking about it much, at least in the early months?
It allowed it to spread a little bit quicker, I think.
How so?
A lot of the health officials, actual government officials, weren't closing down the city because they feared this would cause harm to their Liberty loan efforts. So they were under not necessarily orders or rules, but they wanted their city to do well in Liberty loans, to support the war, to finance this war.
You're talking about Baltimore in particular.
Baltimore, any city, I think, kind of falls under this. It wasn't just a Baltimore phenomenon, but Baltimore certainly, this is what happened. The health official, who was Dr. John Blake at the time, was constantly saying, you don't need to fear the flu. There's nothing to fear. It's just going to go, and it's going to be the same flu that we've experienced before. There's nothing to worry about. And this was all because he didn't want to cancel Liberty loan parades. He didn't want to stop people from buying goods or supporting the war effort or to, you know, stress them out or have fear spread across the city because he feared that that would actually cause weakened immune systems and people who are stressing. When you're under stress, you do weaken your immune system. That was his theory.
Did that change at some point?
Yes, it did. But in many ways, it seems like it was pretty late. So he's claiming in September of 1918, September 22nd, around that point, don't worry, there's nothing to fear. It's not here in Baltimore yet. By September 28th, there's the first instances of the flu in the city at Mercy Hospital. By the middle of October, you have the highest number of deaths and number of new cases of the flu being reported in Baltimore. So you're talking less than a month, the flu's hitting hard, and they're still not quarantining the city. He doesn't quarantine the city until a couple days after it hits the hardest, and that's around October 8th. And actually, it's the schools that close first.
The public schools.
The public schools, yes. The superintendent of the schools cites that there's so many absentees of students and teachers that he can't keep the schools open anymore, so he closes. Despite Dr. Blake saying, please don't, he didn't want people to panic. He didn't want people to be fearful.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Tara Wink, historical librarian and archivist at the Health Sciences and Human Services Library at UMD Baltimore. We're talking about the exhibit, The 1918 Flu Epidemic and Baltimore 100 Years Later, on view now at the school's Frieda O. Weiss Gallery. What about the number of lives lost?
Baltimore lost 4,125 people. Compare that to the state of Maryland lost over 5,000 in World War I. That's the whole state of Maryland lost that many in World War I.
In the war.
For Baltimore alone, during the flu pandemic, 4,125 people died. 24,000 people caught the flu in Baltimore.
Baltimore was the fourth largest death toll in the country?
That's what sources said at the time, yeah. Sources being newspapers reported that, yeah.
Tell me more about what was going on at the university.
The school didn't have a huge loss because they closed. All schools closed, including universities, private schools closed at some point during the epidemic. And what you see mostly are students in the yearbooks. That's where most of my information comes from, talking about how school was closed and how that was either exciting and, you know, a mini vacation, or it was just a disruption in their studies and they just wanted to complete their studies and be done. Other students did work during the flu, so they were called upon by the university hospitals to serve because doctors were at a shortage, nurses were at a shortage. It was a premium for medical professionals because there was so much sickness. And the war also called other nurses and doctors to Europe. So students at the University of Maryland Baltimore were called upon because of the shortage in health professionals to work in university hospitals and in private homes just to help take care of the huge numbers of sick people.
What did you learn in researching this that surprised you most?
The patent medicines were unbelievably interesting to read about, and these different medicines that claim to cure or prevent the flu. Formaldehyde tablets were one of the many that were advertised as preventing the flu. Laxatives claimed that if you had a healthy digestive system, there wouldn't be germs in your digestive system, so you could prevent and fight off the flu. And then the third one were smokeless cigarettes. Then the concept was if you were smoking, you're clearing out your lungs and keeping germs out of your lungs. These are just unbelievable claims that, you know, today's medical field has proven wrong, and it's just so interesting to read about. If I can add one more thing that surprised me, it's the number of people who died who may have had a fighting chance. There really was a fear surrounding the flu. People were afraid to go anywhere near people who were sick. So I read instances where people died at home because there was no one there to take care of them. No one was willing to go into their homes and help them get better, to feed them. So people would die of starvation rather than from the flu itself.
What would you like people to take from this exhibit?
Get your flu shot. There's so much that I would like people to take from it. One being, today we have preventative methods to make sure that we don't spread this illness. And we know a lot more about it than what they did in 1918. However, the idea that government officials at the time were looking at Americans and trying to protect them from fear or from panic, but they were also harming them by not giving them the proper health information. And I think it's important to recognize that a lot of what was going on in 1918 is still prevalent today. Being well-educated about healthcare is important. Being well-educated about what can prevent sicknesses and how to keep yourself healthy, that's an important message in this story.
I appreciate you talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tara Wink, historical librarian and archivist at the Health Sciences and Human Services Library at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. We're talking about the exhibit, The 1918 Flu Epidemic and Baltimore, 100 Years Later, on view at the Frieda O. Weiss Gallery within the University of Maryland Health Sciences and Human Services Library, located at 601 West Lombard Street. It's in conjunction with the exhibit Outbreak, Epidemics in a Connected World, on view at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington. We have links at the On the Record page at WIPR.org with more information about both exhibits, as well as for the opening event at UMD Baltimore that happens tomorrow, Thursday, September 13th at 10:30 a.m. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. After the break, we'll ask a UMB vaccine development specialist how the flu spreads and what you can do to protect yourself from it. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking about the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. 100 years ago, the virus began to infect an estimated 500 million people worldwide, about one-third of the planet's population. About 675,000 Americans died from it, and 4,125 of those were in Baltimore City. We spoke earlier to Tara Wenk, an archivist at the Health Sciences and Human Services Library at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. That's where you can view the exhibit, The 1918 Flu Epidemic and Baltimore, 100 Years Later, at the Frieda O. Weiss Gallery. With us now is Dr. Wilbur Chen, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and a research scientist at the Center for Vaccine Development. He's here to discuss how influenza spreads and ways to prevent it. Welcome to On the Record, Professor Chen.
Thanks for having me.
We hear about seasonal flu and epidemic or pandemic influenza. Explain the difference.
Seasonal influenza is what we see every year. It's one of the large reasons why we encourage everyone in the population to get their vaccinations in the fall for every year. Pandemic influenza is a rare occurrence, but when it does occur, it's a huge ordeal for public health officials, and it represents a completely new virus. So the seasonal viruses are viruses that are similar to each other, and we describe them as drifted viruses. And then the pandemic viruses are described as shifted viruses. And a shift is different from a drift because the antigenic characteristics, basically what it looks like to the human immune system, is completely different. And that's why it's novel and new to the body, and it can cause more severe infections to an entire population.
More severe infections, does it also behave differently in terms of who gets infected? Pandemic versus seasonal?
Yes, that is another characteristic of pandemic influenza. So seasonal influenza affects usually the youngest and the oldest parts of the population. So we describe it as a U-shaped curve because if you look at age, you'll see the peak really at the beginning of our lifetime and then at the end of our lifetime, so it's a U-shape. With pandemic influenza, you have this characteristic where it affects healthy young adults or young adults in the population that usually don't get influenza, and that peak in the middle creates what's called a W-shaped curve for morbidity and mortality for influenza.
Why do you think the Spanish flu in 1918 spread as fast as it did?
Well, I think I would argue that 2009 pandemic flu that we had, the H1N1, spread faster than the 1918 flu.
Really?
I think that if you look at the timeline for how this virus emerged initially
the
2009
virus.
And how it moved through the U.S. and then multiple different countries within the span of just 2 months, that was extremely fast. But that's the characteristic of a pandemic influenza, is that because the population at large, the global population, has never seen the virus before, there's no underlying immunity, and so it spreads through that population very quickly. In 1918, it spread rather quickly, but I think that the rapidness of spread was slowed because our modes of transportation were slower back then. We didn't have airplanes that were transatlantic and flying across the world within just hours. So what you saw was the 1918 influenza crossing the country mostly by railway, following railway, or boat cruises or other means of transportation.
So even though lots of people were moving around because of World War I, or what they called the Great War, it really wasn't comparable to what we'd see with that many people moving today because people move faster.
That's right.
Could a pandemic on the scale of the 1918 Spanish flu happen today?
We think it's possible. And that's what a lot of public health officials are trying to plan for pandemic preparedness is what we call it. And the worst case scenario, or one of the scenarios, the severe scenario, is the 1918 flu type of an event where you have that level of severity. Again, I'll just, you know, compare to 2009 H1N1. That was a pandemic, but it was really very mild in comparison, and almost like seasonal influenza in terms of the morbidity and mortality that we saw.
So, but surely there's been a lot of new medicine, a lot of differences.
That's right. So now we have antivirals that we can use against influenza if we catch it early enough. We have antibacterials, which antimicrobials and antibiotics, which are important because we can have a bacterial infection after an influenza infection. And so those are all things that we can do in the modern age. And now we have intensive care units with mechanical ventilation and other means to support someone when they're very ill. And these were not things that were in existence in 1918. So we have made a lot of progress on the front for medical supportive care and some treatments, but we're still concerned about the level of severity of disease and how even just the number of ill people can overwhelm our existing medical infrastructure. So what I'm saying is that you can have a lot of ill people that simply are overwhelming our local medical clinics and hospitals to the extent that there are not enough beds or enough physicians to see these people.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Wilbur Chen, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and a research scientist at the Center for Vaccine Development. We're talking about the 1918 Spanish flu, how influenza can spread, and ways to prevent it. What are government health officials doing to protect populations from or potentially treat pandemics?
There are a number of things. One front is to try to create vaccines as early as possible, and this is a preemptive measure. So what we've been doing, at least at the Center for Vaccine Development, is work with the NIH and try to test newer vaccines that are based on some of the bird flu viruses that are circulating that we predict might become pandemic influenza at some point. And it's really a guessing game. But what we're doing is trying to make these vaccines well ahead of time that we think that have pandemic potential, and then test them so that there is, if in the possibility of having a flu outbreak with one of these bird viruses, then we might have a vaccine that's already on the shelf and available that has been at least under limited test. So that's one scenario, is making vaccines as early on as possible. Another thing is stockpiling. This is something that the government does, and they have stockpiles of anti-influenza agents, the Tamiflu, and some other anti-influenza agents. So I think predominantly people would understand Tamiflu is one of the medications that you can take to treat influenza. Stockpiling even just simple gloves, masks, gowns, those sorts of things, and even mechanical ventilators, because in the scenario when we have a pandemic, we could potentially run out of those simple supplies very, very quickly. And those are supplies that are going to be necessary to respond to a pandemic.
This question may be obvious, but let me ask it. What are the best ways to protect oneself from the flu virus?
A number of means. So I think I already mentioned getting your flu shot every year. But certainly on a personal level, I want to just encourage people to observe simple hand hygiene, cough etiquette, and even social distancing, which means that if you are sick yourself or have children that are sick, that you keep them at home so that you don't spread it to the rest of the population. And the reverse is true, that hopefully your colleagues or people at school would keep themselves at home rather than spreading it at the workplace or other public meeting places where, again, a lot of people are mixing and potentially can get the virus.
As you mentioned, we need to get vaccinated every year to address the latest strains of flu. Is there a universal flu vaccine on the horizon?
I wish there were. So there are a lot of really smart people, much smarter than me, that are working on so-called universal flu vaccines. I think that there have been some exciting candidates that are coming up, so there's some progress. We won't have a universal flu vaccine for some years, so it's not something that's around the corner, but that is something that people are working on.
I appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Wilbur Chen, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and a research scientist at the Center for Vaccine Development. You can learn more about how flu spreads and how to thwart it at the UMB exhibit, The 1918 Flu Epidemic in Baltimore, 100 Years Later, on view at the Frieda O. Weiss Gallery within the UMB Health Sciences and Human Services Library. That's at 601 West Lombard Street. It's in conjunction with the Smithsonian's exhibit, Outbreak, Epidemics in a Connected World. That's on view at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History on the Mall in Washington, where Professor Chen will be speaking in 2 weeks on Wednesday, September 26th at 6:45 p.m. We have links at the On the Record page, wypr.org, with more information about all these events and exhibits. I'm Sheila Cass. This is On the Record. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.